You are listening to RudolfSteinerAudio.com. If you are listening to the podcast of this, it is located at RudolfSteiner.podbean.com. Please consider becoming a patron. As well, there are two publishing houses, SteinerBooks.org in America and RudolfSteinerPress.com in England, who are the sole publishers of Steiner into English and have given me permission to do these recordings. Please consider patronizing them as well. This is a reading of a collected works, volume 175 of Rudolf Steiner's collected works, entitled Building Stones for an Understanding of the Mystery of Golgotha, Human Life in a Cosmic Context, translated by Simon Blaxland DeLange, 17 lectures. First full reading of this entire set. This is lecture 16 of 17 lectures, given in Berlin on the 1st of May, 1917. In these lectures, I have been speaking about some of the earliest events in the development of Western civilization. As you have seen, however, my purpose in doing so was to discover from such thoughts as may emerge from these studies of antiquity what is of importance for the present. My intention today is to develop this line of inquiry in a similar direction. Our present time, as one can see from a cursory glance, is an age where the only thoughts that have real influence are those which have been derived from the mysteries underlying human evolution. In order to sense the full implications of such a statement, we need, quite apart from being awake to many other things, to be acutely aware of the needs and shortcomings of present-day thinking, feeling, and willing. It is evident from this that our present age has need of new thoughts, impulses, and ideas, and, moreover, of such a kind that spring from the very foundations of the spiritual life, which is the object of spiritual scientific research. There is much about our present times that must be viewed with a certain sadness, although this sadness should never be something that makes us despondent, but on the contrary, can prepare us adequately for work and new endeavors in our time. In recent weeks, a book appeared, and if I may say so, when I acquired it, I had the feeling that it would give me the greatest pleasure. It has been written by a man who is one of the few who have been able to show an interest in our spiritual scientific endeavors. And I might have wished that he could have included some aspects of this research in his own creative work. I am referring to the book titled The State as Organism by Rudolf Kjellin, the Swedish political economist. When I had read the book, I have to say that it left me with a sense of melancholy, because I could see the extent to which this person, who, as I have said, could be interested in spiritual science, is removed in his thinking from those thoughts which are so clearly needed today, and which indeed, and which need to be clearly formulated if they are to be able to influence the way that our modern age is developing. Kjellin, readers aside, Kjellin is spelled K-J-E-L-L, E with a grave, N. I am pronouncing that Kjellin. Apologize for any mispronunciation. End of readers aside. Kjellin endeavors to study the state, and one has the feeling that at no point does he possess the necessary ideas or insights to enable him to have even the most remote possibility of solving his problem, or to come anywhere near to doing so. It is a melancholy experience, which, as I have said, should not make one despondent, but should, on the contrary, reinforce one's determination to meet the challenges of one's time, to have to make such discoveries again and again. Before I elaborate further about matters such as this, I should first like to focus your attention once again upon aspects of early history, and specifically upon that which, as you can easily imagine from the indications that I recently gave you about the destructive element in the Christian Church, is made only very dimly apparent through ordinary historical research, and which must therefore be illuminated through spiritual science. In my previous lecture, I mentioned the incredible fury that accompanied the destruction of ancient works of art by the Christian Church as it expanded its sphere of influence in the early Christian centuries, and how much this growing Christian world erased from earthly existence. It is not possible to take an impartial view of Christianity without being prepared to consider this other aspect of what is going on with complete objectivity. And you need to be aware, moreover, that you are bound to receive a certain picture from the various books that have been written on this subject. Everyone who has received even the minimum of education will have been given a picture of the cultural development of the ancient world, of that world that preceded Christianity. But just imagine how different this picture that people receive today would have been if Archbishop Theophilus of Alexandria had not, in A.D. 391, burned 700,000 rolls containing highly important cultural documents from Roman, Egyptian, Indian, and Greek literature and their cultural life. Consider for a moment how different the accounts in the books would be if these 700,000 rolls had not gone up in flames. From this you will be able to form a picture of what a history of the past that relies entirely upon documents actually is, and equally, what it is not. Let us now take up the train of thought that I outlined last time. I made it clear that in many respects the ritualistic life of Christianity derived its inspiration from ancient symbols and ceremonies of the mysteries, while, on the other hand, the Church ensured that the forms of these rituals and symbols were, to all intents and purposes, completely eradicated. The Church made a clean sweep of these ancient forms of worship, so that people had no knowledge of what had preceded their time, and therefore devoted themselves solely to what the Church offered. This was indeed the course that human evolution followed. And we must be prepared to acknowledge, without dwelling on such pessimistic feelings as we may have, that it is not always a path of straightforward progress. In my previous lecture, I also drew your attention to the fact that much that formed part of the rituals of the Roman Church goes back, on the one hand, to the Eleusinian mysteries, which were, however, interrupted in their development, because, as I indicated, Julian the Apostate did not receive the recognition that he desired and was unable to fulfill his intentions. But, to an even greater extent, what came to be manifested in later times flowed from the Mithras mysteries. However, the spirit of the Mithras mysteries, that which justified their existence and was the source of their essential spiritual substance, can no longer be investigated in the ordinary way, because there was a determination to wipe away all traces of their existence. Some insight into their true nature can therefore only be gained if one endeavors to form some conception of it through spiritual scientific research. Today I want to give you some idea of just one particular aspect of the Mithras mysteries. There is, of course, far, far more to say about these Mithras mysteries than I can possibly say today, but it is best to approach an understanding of such matters by becoming familiar with some particular details. In order that we may understand the Mithras mysteries, which continued to have a considerable influence extending right into Western Europe in the first centuries of the Christian era, in their essential nature, we need to be aware that they were founded wholly upon a basic view that was entirely right and appropriate in the ancient world prior to the mystery of Golgotha. This basic view was that the human community, or individual human communities, such as folk communities or other communities within particular peoples or ethnic groups, do not merely consist of the separate atoms that one can call human beings, but that if what was going on was to be rooted in reality, a group spirit or community spirit of supersensible origin must be living in the community concerned. A community did not simply consist of the number of heads that could be counted in it, but it represented for these people the outward manifestation, even the incarnation, if I may use such a word here, of the actual community spirit concerned. Moreover, the aim of those who were received into these mysteries was to live in community with this spirit, to share in its thoughts. And it was regarded as essential that no single human being should remain isolated with his own obstinately egotistic thoughts, feelings, and will impulses, but that each one should live in such a way as to be receptive to the thoughts of the group spirit. Specifically in the Mithras Mysteries, there was the awareness that this aim cannot be achieved if one views a wider human community merely in terms of those who presently constitute it. For through the purely contemporary aspect, what resides within the community spirit is significantly obscured. For it was said, the dead are also part of present realities, and the more that one can live with those who have long been dead, the better and more rightly one will live in the present. Indeed, the longer the people concerned had been dead, the more beneficial it was found to be to live with their spirit. What was best of all was to be able to live in community with the spirit of the ancestor of a tribe, a folk community, or a race, by forming a connection with his soul. For the assumption was that this soul achieves a further development once it has passed through the portal of death, and that it has a deeper insight into what is to occur here on the earth than those who are living on this earth incarnated in a physical body. Thus the whole purpose of these mysteries lay in establishing ceremonies and rituals that could bring the neophyte in contact with the spirits who had, for the most part, died long or even very long ago. Those who had been admitted to these mysteries had to undergo a first stage of initiation, which was usually referred to by means of an expression derived from the bird world. They were called, in quotes, ravens. A raven was someone who was at the first level of initiation. Through particular mystery rituals, powerful symbols, and richly artistic dramatic ceremonies, he learned to be aware not only of what one sees with one's physical eyes in the surrounding world, or what one learns from one's fellow human beings, but what the dead are thinking. He acquired a certain capacity to remember the dead, and the ability to develop this capacity further. Such a raven had an obligation, namely that he was strictly required to be thoroughly awake to the present moment and to observe everything around him with open, clearly focused eyes, to acquaint himself with human needs and familiarize himself with the natural world. Anyone who daydreams and has no feeling for what is living in man and in nature was not regarded as suitable for being received into the mysteries, for only a person who actively observed life in the world around him was equipped for the task that he had to fulfill in the mysteries. His task was that he had to try as hard as he could to become involved in all the various situations of life in the outer world in order to deepen his experience, to share in the joys and sorrows of the events taking place around him. Someone who was unresponsive to current events was not a suitable candidate, for his first task within the mysteries was to re-enact what he had experienced in the world around him in the environment of the mysteries. In this way, these experiences provided information for the dead, for those whose advice was being sought. You might well ask whether an initiate at a higher level would not have been more suitable for this. This was actually not so. First-degree initiates were particularly suitable because they possessed all the feelings, all the sympathies and antipathies that enabled them to relate directly to the outer world, whereas those at a higher level had more or less divested themselves of such trappings. So these first-degree initiates were particularly suited to experience life in the present, in the way that an ordinary person experiences it, and to offer it up to the mysteries. It was therefore the special task of the ravens to mediate between the outer world and those who had long been dead. An echo of this had been preserved in legends, which, as I have often pointed out, by and large rested on deep foundations. Thus, when it is asserted in a legend that Friedrich Barbarossa, long after his death, is instructed in his castle by ravens, or that Charlemagne is taught in, quote, Salzburg amidst the mountains by ravens, close quote, in order to tell him what is going on in the outside world, these are echoes of ancient mysteries, and specifically of the Mithras mysteries. When someone was ready for the second level, he was referred to as an occultist, or a pupil of the mysteries. He thereby became able not only to bring the outer world to the world of the mysteries, but also in the way that information is received from the dead to hear about the impulses which the supersensible world, in which the dead reside, had to impart to the outer world. And only when he was fully integrated into spiritual life as a whole, in its interrelationship between the supersensible and sense-perceptible worlds, was he deemed ready for the third level of initiation, when he was given the possibility of applying in the outside world the impulses that he had received in the mysteries. He was now elected to become a, in quotes, warrior for those supersensible impulses that must be made manifest in the world of the senses. Now, you may well ask whether there was not a deep injustice in the fact that the people as a whole were left in ignorance about matters of the greatest importance, and only certain individuals were initiated. You will, however, only have a proper idea of what lies behind this if you start from the premise that I stated at the outset, namely that there was a group spirit or group soul involved in this situation. It was perfectly acceptable if certain individuals acted on behalf of the whole group of people. They did not feel themselves as individuals, but as members of the group. It was therefore only possible to act in this way at the time when the group soul element, the selfless feeling of belonging to the group, was a living reality. And then, when the initiate had been a warrior for the supersensible world for a certain time, he was considered suitable for establishing smaller groups within the large group, smaller communities that proved to be necessary within larger groups. In those ancient times, there would have been no point in anyone simply setting up an association on his own initiative, as is done today, for nothing would have come of it. In order to establish such a society or association, it was necessary in the Mithras mysteries to be a, in quotes, lion, for that was the fourth level of initiation. Such a person must have consolidated his life in the supersensible worlds through his connection with those impulses which were not confined to the living, but which united the living with the dead. From this fourth level, the initiate was enabled, through certain measures, to rise to take over the leadership of an already existing group or folk community, which included the dead. If we go back to the 8th, 9th, and 10th centuries, before the mystery of Golgotha, we find ourselves in totally different times from today. It would not have occurred to anyone then to claim the right to choose who would do a particular thing. For anyone doing something on behalf of the community had to be initiated to the fifth level. And then at the next level, the initiate was able to gain access to that knowledge which the Sun Mystery, parenthesis, of which he had received intimations, close parenthesis, had implanted in the human soul. And thereafter his path led to the seventh level. I do not need to elaborate on this any further, for what I wanted to do was simply to indicate the nature of the course of development of a person who had to acquire from the spiritual world his capacity to take an active part in community life. As you well know, it was, of course, a necessary part of the evolution of the human race that the whole phenomenon of group souls gradually receded into the background. The situation was such that at the time of the mystery of Golgotha, human souls developed a consciousness of their ego, or I. This had been prepared for many hundreds of years. But the time of the mystery of Golgotha represented a culmination or critical moment in this respect. It would no longer be possible to make the assumption that the individual had the power to carry the whole community with him and to pass on his feelings and impulses selflessly to the whole community. It would be foolish to believe that the course of history might have been different than the one that it has actually followed. But sometimes it might prove fruitful to consider, for example, what would have happened if at the time when Christianity was beginning to make its mark upon human evolution, not absolutely everything had been totally eradicated, but if a certain knowledge, of the kind that those who only believe in documents would have had access to, had been transmitted historically to posterity. But Christianity, in the form of the Church, did not want this to happen. I shall speak on some future occasion about the reasons why it was opposed to this, but today I shall simply state this as a fact. This Christianity was confronted by a totally different kind of humanity, which was not related to the old group spirits in the way that was formerly the case. A humanity where the approach to the individual was totally different than in ancient times, when the individual was not taken into account to any real degree, and when people related to the group spirit and acted out of it. By destroying all documentary evidence of this ancient time for outward perception, Christianity fostered, and even consciously created, a certain obscurity with respect to that age when it first began to develop. It incorporated what it needed into its traditions, its dogmas, and especially into its rituals, and then wiped away all trace of the sources of these rituals. There is an immense amount residing within these rituals, but everything has been given a different interpretation and has been differently formulated. The outward trappings still existed for people to see them, but they were not to know with what ancient wisdom they were connected. Take, for example, a bishop's mitre from the 8th century. This 8th century mitre has clear symbols, but all these symbols are similar, though different in detail, and they are all swastikas. The swastika is embroidered in various different ways on these bishops' mitres. This symbol goes back to the earliest times of the mysteries, and can be traced back to those ancient times when people could observe the activity of the lotus flowers in the human etheric and astral organisms. How what lives in these so-called lotus flowers is one of the most important aspects of etheric and astral forces. But it became a dead symbol. The bishop bore it as a symbol of his authority, and it became a dead symbol through all traces of its origin being effaced. Even what is said in cultural history about the origin of such things has nothing living about it. Only through spiritual science can the living quality in such phenomena be rediscovered. I said earlier that a certain degree of obscurity was created. However, something must again emerge from this darkness, and I think that I have, over the years, said more than enough to make it clearly understood that it is of quite particular importance in our time to have ears for these things that can really hear and eyes that can really see. For our time is one when the darkness that inevitably had to hold sway has run its course, and when a new light, the light of spiritual life, must shine forth. The hope initially would be that many people would in their hearts and souls feel with all the seriousness at their command that this is a necessity for our time, and that what is going on around us and calls forth such sorrow in our time is connected with all these questions. It is already becoming clear that it is not enough to look at things only on the surface, that it is inadequate to speak about the causes of what is going on at present on the basis of superficial observations. For as long as people speak only about what lies on the surface, they will not find the thoughts or be able to develop the impulses that have the potency to lead forth from the obscurity which has been the cause of everything that is happening now. Although I must emphasize once more that we should not become despondent or critical, but simply fulfill the necessary task of observing and interpreting what is going on today, it is indeed remarkable that people in our time are unwilling to look at wider perspectives of evolution, because for the most part they do not as yet manage to see what needs to be done. It is heartbreaking to see how an individual who suffered deeply from the confusion and chaos of the second half of the 19th century, to the point of becoming seriously ill, experienced the darkness and turmoil that prevails in our time. There is much more to Friedrich Nietzsche than merely to regard him as someone whom one enthusiastically follows, as so many have done. To such people he himself addressed these cautionary words, quote, "The house in which I dwells mine own, allegiance bear to me alone, and every master ridicule, who cannot sometimes play the fool." Close quote. This is also the underlying mood of the whole of his title, Thus Spoke Zarathustra. But this has not prevented large numbers of people from following him. This is the one extreme. This extreme is not one that can be fruitful for the present. But the other extreme is certainly not fruitful either. Parenthesis, and between these two extremes there are all manner of shades of opinion, close parenthesis, where the view is expressed that although Nietzsche exhibited many flashes of genius, he eventually went mad and is best ignored. Friedrich Nietzsche is a strange phenomenon who does not deserve anyone's slavish devotion. But in the years of his illness, he experienced with an acute sensitivity the darkness and chaos of our present time. Indeed, I would say that we can create a very good foundation for studying the difficulties of our own time if we take account of what Nietzsche writes about the sorrow that afflicted him. I want to read you two passages from Nietzsche's posthumous book entitled German Versuch einer Entwertung aller Werte, The Will to Power, the Revelation of All Values, which was written when he was already mentally ill, but which could also have been written today with a completely different intention in mind from that of its author, and could have been written with the object of giving expression to the deeper underlying causes of the symptoms of our present time. Nietzsche writes as follows, quote, "What I am relating is the history of the next two centuries. I am describing what is about to happen and what cannot be avoided, the arrival of nihilism. This history can already be written now, for necessity is at work here. The future already cries out in 100 signs. This destiny announces its presence everywhere. All ears are already pricked for this music of the future. The whole of our European culture has long been inexorably moving toward catastrophe in an agony of suspense, which increases from decade to decade, restlessly, violently, precipitously, like a river that surges toward the ocean without any longer pausing to reflect, and even has a dread of doing so. Close quote. Much of what you can experience in the present can be judged by these words of a sensitive human being who wrote them at the end of the 1880s, and they can be compared with another passage that I want to read to you, which vividly portrays the depths to which each of us can plunge in our experience. Quote, "My friends, we had a hard time when we were young. We suffered in our youth as if from a serious illness. This is owing to the time into which we have been cast, an age of great internal decay and disintegration, which, with all its weakness, and even with the best of its strength, is opposed to the spirit of youth. The disintegration, and hence the uncertainty, is peculiar to this age. Nothing is based on a firm foundation and solid beliefs. People live for tomorrow, for anything beyond that is uncertain. Our path is slippery and full of danger, and the ice that bears us has become so thin. We all feel the ominous breath of a thawing wind. Within a short time, no one will be able to walk where we are still able to tread." Close quote. There can be no doubt about these sentiments, that these sentiments have been expressed out of a deep grasp of the realities of the present. Anyone who wishes to understand the age in which we live, and especially the task that any individual who wants to think beyond the confines of everyday life can envisage for himself, will have a similar feeling to what is expressed in these passages. And he will perhaps say that while Nietzsche may have been prevented by the onset of his mental derangement from adopting a critical attitude to the ideas that he had, these ideas arose out of an acute sensitivity to the immediate realities of the present. Perhaps one day such a sensitivity to the present will be compared with what is said by these, in quotes, experts who do not even touch the fringe of the causes that underlie the difficult times in which we live. There will then be a very different attitude regarding the necessity for spiritual science today. For at present it is simply not the case that people want to hear about it. Not that I want to attribute any blame to anyone for this. As I have said, I am very far from wanting to reproach anyone in particular. Those of whom I speak are mostly people whom I regard very highly and whom I would consider the most likely to be receptive to spiritual science. But I need to point out how difficult it is for any individual to be inwardly open to spiritual science if he is up to his ears in what will come his way if he succumbs entirely to the superficial trends that dominate all areas of modern thought. I have now come to the point where I can say a few words about Kjellin's book, titled The State as Organism. This book is really rather curious, because although its author makes every possible effort to give a clear insight to the question as to what the state really is, he has no trust in the power of human beings to generate any ideas or conceptions which could really deal with this question or problem. To be sure, he says many fine things, which, as I have seen, have been greatly admired by modern critics. But he has not the slightest idea of what needs to be known to furnish a solution to humanity's present predicament. I can only mention a certain aspect of what he says. Kjellin begins by asking, what is the relationship of the human individual to the state? As he sets out to tackle this question, he enters immediately into a quandary. He wants to conceive of the state as something real, as an integrated whole, as something living, thus as an organism. Many people have thought of the state as an organism, in which case they always have to find a way of dealing with the question of the cells of which an organism consists. What are the cells of this state? These are the human individuals. And so Kellen's line of thought is as follows. The state is an organism, and just as the human organism consists of individual cells, so is the state made up of individual cells, of human beings. They are its cells. It would be impossible to conceive of a more misguided or misleading analogy than this. For if one builds up a line of thought on this analogy, one can never do man justice. Never. Why is this so? You see, the cells in the human organism are juxtaposed to one another, and this has a particular significance. The whole organization of the human organism depends on this juxtaposition. The human individuals in the state are not in direct contact with one another, as are the individual cells. That is certainly not the case. The human personality is very far from being related to the totality of the state, as are the cells to the organism. And even if one feels obliged to compare the state with an organism, one needs to be quite clear that one will be sorely mistaken, and the same can be said of the whole of political science, if one overlooks the fact that the individual human being is not a cell. For whereas cells together form the organism, and collectively make it what it is, the human individual is the productive or creative element that is able to sustain the state. Thus, when the group spirit is no longer present in the way that it was in former times, the modern state is only able to progress if its functions are carried by the single human individual. This can, however, never be compared with the task of cells. By and large, it is a matter of intelligence what one compares something with. But if a comparison is being made, it needs to be appropriate. And comparisons do, as a general rule, have a certain validity, but they cannot be so far-fetched as Kellen's analogy. He can perfectly well compare the state with an organism. He could also compare it with a machine. There would be no harm in that. Or with something like a penknife, provided that some points in common could be found. But if one is consistently making a comparison, it must be appropriately done. But people are not sufficiently familiar with the basic structure of thinking to be able to perceive something of this kind. So Kellen is fully entitled to compare the state with an organism. But then he must look for the right cells. And the problem is that if one really wants to compare the state with an organism, the right cells cannot be found. It quite simply has no cells. If one thinks about this matter in a realistic way, the idea simply does not add up. I need to put it quite plainly that only if one thinks as abstractly as Kellen does the idea make any kind of sense. Whereas as soon as one thinks in a realistic way, one comes to grief, because the idea has no basis in reality. The cells cannot be found. There are no cells. On the other hand, one finds something completely different. One discovers that individual states can more or less be compared with cells, and the aggregate of all states on earth can then be compared with an organism. One then arrives at a fruitful idea, although it is first necessary to answer the question as to what kind of an organism this is. Where can we find something similar in nature, where cells interact in a manner similar to the way that the cells representing individual states function with regard to the entire organism of the earth? If we pursue this idea, we find that we can only compare the whole earth with a plant organism, not with an animal organism, and still less with a human organism. whereas natural science is concerned with the inorganic realm, with the mineral kingdom. We need to think of the plant kingdom if we want to give a firm foundation to political science. We are not involved here with the animal kingdom, and certainly not with the human world. But we need to free ourselves from a purely mineralized thinking. But political scientists are unable to do this. They remain firmly wedded to the mineralized thinking that governs natural science. They cannot rise in their thinking to the plant kingdom, but apply the laws that have been found in the mineral kingdom to the state and call it political science. In order to arrive at the kind of fruitful idea referred to above, all our thinking must be rooted in spiritual science. We will then also come to the point of realizing that in the entirety of his being, man is, by virtue of his individuality, far superior to the state. He reaches up to the spiritual world, where the state is unable to penetrate. Thus, if you want to compare the state with an organism, and the human individual with cells, you would, if you are thinking realistically, arrive at the idea of a strange organism, an organism that consists of individual cells, but the cells would be growing all over the skin. You would have an organism extending beyond its skin. The cells would be developing wholly on their own, independently of the organism. You would therefore have to picture the organism as if living bristles, which feel themselves to be individuals, were growing all over the skin. Thus you can see how living thinking brings us in touch with reality, how it shows us the impossibilities that we are bound to encounter if we want to understand an idea that is to be fruitful. It is therefore no surprise that ideas that have not been fructified by spiritual science do not have the capacity to address the needs of the real world. For how can there be any hope of organizing earthly affairs if one has no idea what is going on there? No matter how many Wilsonian proclamations are made about all manner of international associations and other similar initiatives, they are nothing but empty talk, unless they are rooted in reality. Hence many of the proposals being put forward today are nothing but hot air. Here you have an instance where you can see how vitally necessary it is that the impulses of spiritual science can be truly influential in our present age. It is the misfortune of our time that it is powerless to formulate ideas that could possibly regulate anything of an organic living nature. Hence everything slides into a state of chaos. But you can now see where the deeper causes lie. It is therefore no surprise if books like Kjellin's The State as Organism conclude in so strange a way. Just consider that we are now living at a time when everyone is wondering what to do to enable people to live in harmony with one another on the earth, in the light of the fact that as every week goes by, they are increasingly determined to kill one another rather than live together. How are they able to live in harmony once more? But the science that is concerned with how people may live together again within the state offers only the following conclusion, as expressed in Kjellin's words, quote, "This must be our final word in this study of the state as an organism. We have seen that the modern state has, for compelling reasons, made very little progress in this direction, and has not as yet become properly conscious of a task of this nature. Nevertheless, we believe in a higher form of state, which enables a rational purpose to be more clearly discerned, and which will strive toward this goal with ever greater confidence." Close quote. This is how the book ends. We do not know anything. We have no idea what will come of everything. This is the net result of a strenuous, dedicated intellectual effort, the concluding summary of a thinker who is so completely identified with present trends of thought that he cannot be receptive to what is really needed. One must recognize such phenomena for what they are. For the impulse to gain insight into these issues only arises if one is quite matter-of-fact about them, if one knows what the driving forces in our time really are. Without even looking very far, one finds that there is a characteristic longing today for a certain social process. Not, I would say, for socialism, but for a socialization of the earthly organism. But because such an endeavor must be conscious in its origin, and not arise from unconsciousness, as was the situation for 2,000 years, socialization, reorientation, or reorganization is only possible if one acquires a knowledge of man. For this was also what the ancient mysteries sought to achieve for former times. Socialization applies to the physical plane. But it is impossible to establish a social order if one is completely unaware that here, on the physical plane, there are not only physical human beings, but people with a soul and a spirit. Nothing can be accomplished, nothing can be achieved, if one thinks of man only in outward physical terms. However much you may try to create social structures along the lines of present-day thinking, everything will descend into chaos again if you disregard the fact that man is not merely the being that natural science acknowledges, but is endowed with a soul and a spirit. For the soul and the spirit exert real influence. Although they may not figure in our ideas and conceptions, they cannot be abolished. But if the soul is to be able to inhabit a body, which is part of an outward structure appropriate for our time, it must, as a matter of priority, have freedom of thought, the right to make up one's own mind. No social process can dispense with freedom of thought, and no socialization or freedom of thought is conceivable unless the spirit is firmly established within the spiritual world itself. Freedom of thought as an attitude of mind, together with pneumatology, spiritual wisdom, spiritual science as a scientific basis for all social arrangements, these aspects are inseparably linked with one another. However, we can only discover, through spiritual scientific study, how they relate to man, and how they can be manifested as an outward social reality. Freedom of thought, that is, an attitude of mind toward one's fellow human beings that truly recognizes the other person's freedom of thought in the fullest sense of the word, cannot become a reality unless one's perception of the other is based upon the idea of repeated earthly lives. For otherwise, one will be looking upon the other person as an abstraction. One will never be able to see him as he really is, unless one views him as the result of former earthly lives. The whole question of reincarnation must be considered in connection with that of freedom of opinion or freedom of thought. It will, in future, become impossible to function in the real world if the individual is not inwardly rooted within the life of the spirit. I am not implying that he must become clairvoyant, although some people certainly will. I am simply stating that there needs to be a firm grounding in spiritual life. I have often explained that this is perfectly possible without being clairvoyant. If we look about us, we shall realize where the major obstacles lie and where we need to look in order to find the sources of these obstacles. For it is not the case that people are unwilling to search for the truth. As I have said, I do not want to reprove or criticize unduly, but the impediments obstructing the soul's progress in this regard are indeed very considerable. There may sometimes be an isolated instance that is so illuminating that it is possible to understand many contemporary phenomena from such symptoms. It is, for example, quite remarkable how people who are otherwise so brave and courageous become terribly anxious when they hear that spiritual knowledge may acquire some degree of credibility. They really cannot cope with this. I have often told you that I have met several people who have heard one or two of my lectures, and then they are never seen again. When I meet them in the street, I ask them why they did not return. quote, I could not, said one. I feared lest I became convinced, close quote. Someone who speaks like that finds the idea of being convinced highly problematic and thoroughly disagreeable, and he does not have the courage, does not have the strength or courage to take responsibility for this. There are many other experiences that I could cite in this connection, but I would rather mention symptoms from public life. I spoke a short while ago about Hermann Bahr, who recently gave a lecture in Berlin called titled The Ideas of 1914. I pointed out how this man, and you need only read his last novel, titled Himmelfahrt, Ascension, how this man does not only try to approach spiritual science to some extent, but has even tried, in his later years, to familiarize himself with Goethe, and hence follow the path that I would also recommend for anyone who wants to find a good foundation for spiritual science. Many people today have a strong wish to speak once again of the spirit, and they would welcome the opportunity to do so. I do not want to sound like a schoolmaster, and certainly not with a person whom I like as much as Hermann Bahr. But however reluctant I may be to pontificate about such matters, the influence of such an intellectual outlook on the corruption of thought, even to the point of leading thoughts into what could be said to be a kind of original sin, is sometimes clearly apparent in some strange way. Now, in his recent lecture here in Berlin about ideas relating to 1914, Hermann Bahr expressed all sorts of fine sentiments. But there are a number of strange discoveries to be made. Thus, he began by saying that this war has taught us something completely new. It has taught us to find a right way of integrating the individual once more into the whole. It has taught us to overcome individualism and egotism and to serve the whole community. It has taught us to get rid of old ideas and to replace them with something entirely new. And he went on to characterize and define all the many new things that this war has brought us. I do not want to criticize him for this, indeed quite the contrary. But it is very strange if, after long discussions about how the war has transformed us all and how we are becoming very different because of it, we hear these concluding words. Quote, man always hopes for better times, but in himself he remains incorrigible. However, the war will hardly be likely to change anything very much. Close quote. As I say, I do not want to sermonize, but I simply cannot help being aware of such things. All the same, such people are full of good intentions. They would like to make contact with the spiritual domain. Bahr, therefore, emphasizes that we have based everything for too long upon the individual. We have become obsessed with the idea of individualism. We must learn once again to form a whole. He believes that people who belong to a particular nation have learned to feel themselves as belonging to the totality of a nation, and hence to limit the exclusivity of individualism. But nations, he thinks, are themselves also individualities, and a greater whole needs to emerge out of them. It sometimes becomes apparent, and in this lecture it does so in a remarkable way, that Bahr pursues particular paths in order to find the spirit. He sometimes does this rather vaguely, but these indications, nevertheless, give quite a lot away. The old is finished with, he says. The Enlightenment wanted to ensure that people base everything upon reason, but this did not come to anything, and we are now in a state of chaos. We must once more find something that brings us in touch with the absolute, rather than with chaos. And then he makes some very noteworthy remarks. Quote, perhaps nations would then have learned something that is very difficult for them, as it is for individuals, namely to grant the right to a particular nature that each demands for itself also to others. And it is, moreover, the case that the particular nature of others is ultimately the precondition of one's own. For if all were alike, there would be no distinctive qualities. And they would have learned that just as each individual citizen with his distinctive gifts is necessary in his own particular area, in order to make his contribution to what the nation is able to achieve, and thus find self-fulfillment, while at the same time serving the whole, so does the universal cathedral of mankind, whose spire reaches up to God, arise from the nations as an overarching dome. Close quote. This is a hint, albeit not a blatant one, but nevertheless a pretty clear hint. What is expressed here is an aspiration to gain access to God, to the spiritual world. But there is a reluctance to do so in the way that is appropriate for our time. And so a different avenue is sought, which does indeed exist, but it does not occur to the author that this avenue was effective until 1914. And that in order to overcome what it brought about, he is advocating that we return to it. However, the symptoms that I am presenting to you here are worth some quiet investigation. For these are not only the views of a single individual, but a considerable number of people think and especially feel in this way. A book recently appeared by Max Scheler with the title The Genius of the War and the German War. I think highly of it. It is a good book. Barr also admires it. Barr is a man of good taste and well-informed, and has every reason to like the book. But he wants his praise to be made public. In other words, he wants to write a really favorable review of it. He thinks to himself, quote, I want to write a really good review to give Scheler a good boost, but how shall I do this? I could do it in such a way that people feel offended, but it is not good to cause them offense. I must find some other way of approaching them. But how? Close quote. Now, Hermann Barr is a very upright, honest person, and he explains pretty candidly what he would do in such a case. Thus, at the beginning of the article that he has written about Scheler, he says that Scheler has written many articles and many other things to indicate how we can extricate ourselves from our present misery, and that what he wrote caught the attention of many. But people today, according to Barr, do not appreciate being directed toward a particular individual. And so Hermann Barr characterizes Scheler by saying, quote, people were curious about him and were somewhat mistrustful of him. Germans want first and foremost to know where they stand in relation to an author. They do not like imprecision of any kind. Close quote. But where can we find precision? Not by reading books and following their reasoning. Something else is needed for this. People do not like imprecision. Again, Barr gives a hint of what he really wants to say. Quote, similarly, in the Catholic world, there was a tendency to withhold judgment to avoid being disappointed. Here, too, it was his idiom that alienated people. For in every intellectual atmosphere, a distinctive idiom emerges in the course of time, which creates a particular vernacular out of words in common usage. Through this, one recognizes who the author is, with the result that one ultimately pays less attention to what is said than to how it is said. Close quote. Now, what has Hermann Barr actually decided to do? He has resolved to announce Scheler with a good fanfare. Scheler is, in his words, rather like Barr himself, in that he proclaims these distinctively Catholic aspirations with perhaps a few matches, though not quite with torches. Now, according to Barr, Scheler does not speak like a dyed-in-the-wool Catholic. But Catholics do, after all, want to know how they stand in relation to Scheler, and I myself, Hermann Barr is speaking personally here, am exemplifying this tendency through the great fanfare I am making on Scheler's behalf in the Catholic journal titled Hochland, on the grounds that people really need to know that Scheler can be recommended to Catholics. They do not like imprecision. They want to have clarity. So, this is what it is all about. A clear picture is being created to show people that Catholics are perfectly safe with Scheler. It is of no consequence if he is also a highly intelligent man, for Catholics won't have any problem with that. Barr, however, wants to portray Scheler as a really great man, so that he can tootle his fanfare. But at the same time he does not want to offend anyone. To begin with, he bewails the fact that people have become so shallow, that they have lost their connection with the Spirit, and that they need to recover it again. I shall quote a few passages from what Hermann Bahr writes about Scheler. Quote, "Reason severed itself from the Church on the basis of the presumption that it can of itself understand, determine, order, control, direct, and shape life." Close quote. Hermann Bahr does not have the courage to say that reason must now seek the spiritual world or something of the kind. So he says that reason must again look to the Church for guidance. Quote, "Reason severed itself from the Church on the basis of the presumption that it can of itself understand, determine, order, control, direct, and shape life. It had hardly begun to attempt to do these things when it became fearful, when it lost confidence in itself. This consciousness of reason in its own right, this awareness of its limitations, of the extent of its own powers when set loose from God, begins with Kant. Kant recognized that reason out of itself cannot achieve what is constantly required to do out of its own forces, what it is constantly required to do out of its own forces. He called a halt precisely when something might have come of this endeavor. He denied its right to find its wings. But his pupils exceeded the boundaries that he set and tried to outdo each other in the process. Nothing remained for godless reason other than to renounce its claims. It finally realized that it cannot know anything. It searched for truth until it found that none exists, whether because this is inherently the case or simply that man is not capable of discovering it." Close quote. Well, this does abundant justice to the way people feel nowadays, for all those fine sentiments about the limits to knowledge are very clearly expressed. Quote, "Since then we have lived without truth, believing that we know that there is no truth, and yet we continue to live as if truth must nevertheless exist. In order to live, we had to live in defiance of our reason. We therefore preferred to abandon reason altogether. Man's head was amputated from his body. He soon came to be regarded as consisting only of desires. He became an animal and gloried in the fact. The consequence of this was 1914. Close quote. Thus Hermann Bahr paints a picture of what Scheler resolves through his Catholic impulse. He then somewhat abuses Goethe by making an extended effort to present him as a dyed-in-the-wool Catholic. And he goes on to say, quote, "The modern, in quotes, man of science renounced this belief in being an honorable part of the spiritual world. Science abandoned all presuppositions. Reason ceased to derive the impulse wherewith alone it is able to function from God. Where else can it come from? Only from desires. There were no other possibilities. Thus, bereft of all established values, man lost the ground from under his feet, and the result was 1914. If we are to build everything up again, it must be done from the foundations. It would be presumptuous to try to rebuild Europe in a cultural sense immediately. We must begin quietly, from below. Man must first be restored to himself in his lost innocence. He must once again become conscious of himself, of being an integral part of the spiritual world. Freedom, individuality, dignity, morality, science, and art have vanished, since faith, hope, and love have lost their central focus. Only faith, hope, and love can restore him. We have no other choice. The end of the world, or omnia instaurare in Christo, to renew everything through Christ." Close quote. Try that. Sorry about the Latin, readers aside, and a readers aside. However, this omnia instaurare in Christo does not imply reaching toward the Spirit. This is Steiner again, an endeavor to explore and study the spiritual world, but rather encompassing all nations within the orb of the Catholic Church. But how do we achieve this, says Bahr? How is it possible for people to be able to think and yet become good Catholics? We must look to those who are suited to the challenges of our present time. Here Shaler is right, for he does not compromise himself by speaking of an evolution into the spiritual world or of a particular aspect of spiritual teaching. He does not compromise himself by venturing to say more than that one can speak in this way about the Spirit and then find everything else if you enter the Church, and moreover the Catholic Church. For this view, which seeks to satisfy everyone on an international scale, is what is upheld by both Barr and Shaler. In this way, everyone can be brought under one roof, or under the one umbrella of the Church. Nevertheless, people today still want to think for themselves, and Shaler is quite happy to adapt himself to the way they want to think. Indeed, says Barr, he does well to think in the way that people want. Quote, Shaler does not raise his voice or gesticulate, but he attracts attention by these very means. For people ask, involuntarily, who can it be who seems to be so sure of the effect that he is having that he does not consider it necessary to make a lot of noise? It is a proven device of experienced speakers to begin with a quiet voice and thus compel the audience to be quiet and attentive, though they must also have the power to captivate them. Shaler is a master in this respect. A listener who does not notice where he is being led is guided firmly toward a goal that he had no intention of aiming for. Shaler's art of persuasion, beginning from wholly innocuous propositions, in response to which the reader or listener allows himself, without judgment, to be forced imperceptibly into conclusions which, had he had the slightest warning, he would have resisted with all his might, is quite unparalleled. He is a born teacher. I know of no one who is able to guide our troubled age to the truth with a hand that is at once so gentle and yet so firm. Close quote. Steiner again. It is indeed a special art if one can take people by surprise in this way. First one tells them things that are perfectly innocuous, and then the argument gradually unfolds until one leads them to a conclusion that they would have actively resisted if one had presented them with it from the start. How is one to account for this? Barr asks. And what must one do in order that it happens in the right way? He is very sincere, very honest. And so in this review about Shaler, he tries to address this issue in what he has to say. Quote, the question now is whether the average German has learned to grasp the enormity of the present moment. With the best will in the world, he still imagines that modern man has lost all belief, that faith of any kind has been scientifically refuted. It does not enter his head that, in the meantime, this science of unbelief has itself long been scientifically refuted. He knows nothing of the quiet preparatory work undertaken by the great German thinkers of our time, Lotze, Franz Brentano, Eucken, and Husserl. Close quote, Steiner again. And now, I beg you to pay special attention to the following words. Quote, in the ears of the average person, there can constantly be heard the fading echo of the latest aberration, which has already been overcome. Amidst the numbing confusion that he feels, a calm, clear voice will most likely be heard, which does not arouse any suspicion of having fallen prey to the rapturous enthusiasm, romanticism, and mysticism of which the average German has a terrible dread. Precisely because Shaler upholds the cause of reverting to the Spirit in such a non-effusive and unemotional way, and in the familiar jargon of modern culture, he is the man we need today. Close quote. Steiner again. So now we have it. You now see exactly what Barr likes about Shaler. He cannot be accused of being a dreamer or a mystic, for, quote, the average German, close quote, has a terrible dread of such qualities. And by God, one really needs to respect this fear. For if it were to occur to anyone to try to get rid of it, if someone came to regard it as necessary to combat it, not even all the courage that could possibly be devoted to such an undertaking would be adequate to the task. Because I have a high opinion of Hermann Barr, and am also very fond of him, I would like to show how characteristic he is of those who find it difficult to accept something that is so necessary for our time. The only way to find a way forward out of this situation is that we cease to be paralyzed by this terrible dread, and that we pluck up the courage to acknowledge that spiritual science is not some kind of effusive fantasy, but that a considerable degree of clarity of thought is necessary if we are to do justice to it. For clarity of thought is not exactly a prominent feature of the few examples that I have given you in today's lecture of passages from the work of Hermann Bahr and other contemporary writers. However, a certain degree of courage on the intellectual plane is required if we want to find ideas with penetrating power and resilience. We should not follow Nietzsche beyond a certain point, nor do we need to agree with everything that he says in a passage which may attract our attention. But we must be able to accompany this sensitive spirit when perhaps prompted by an illness. He gives expression to thoughts of so courageous a nature. Similarly, we should not be governed by a fear of being misunderstood. It would be the most awful thing that could happen today if we were to have a dread of being misunderstood by someone or other. For it is sometimes necessary to pass judgments such as the following one made by Nietzsche, even though it is not necessarily justified in every detail, and that is not of any great importance. Nietzsche writes the following words on his treatise titled On the History of Christianity, quote, "One should not confuse Christianity as an historical reality with that one root to which its name is linked. The other roots, out of which it has grown, have been far more dominant. It is an unparalleled abuse of a word if such decadent structures and monstrosities as the Christian church, Christian belief, and Christian life are associated with that holy name. What did Christ deny? Everything that is called Christian today." Close quote. Even though this is perhaps taken to an extreme, Nietzsche has touched upon something that has a certain validity, even if he expresses it rather radically. There is some truth in the suggestion that if Christ were to appear in our midst today, he would in all probability be most strongly opposed to what is generally referred to as Christian, in quotes, today, together with much else besides, which I shall speak about at another opportunity. We will take up these threads again next Tuesday. The end of Lecture 16.